Welcome to Bible Study for Progressives, a show where moderates, liberals, and leftists of all faiths and ideologies come together to discuss scripture, spirituality, and politics. Today's show is entitled Think Impunity, Understanding Arrogance and Pride in the Bible. In modern usage, arrogance or pride often describes someone who is haughty or holier than thou. In some, someone who thinks they're better than others. This, however, does not represent a full understanding of the terms, especially as they are used in the Bible. We will be reading from an ancient Jewish text, the Book of Sirach, in order to better understand the meaning of these words. I wrote this reading for today's show in late August of 2013. I wrote it near the beginning of the Syrian Civil War when Hillary Clinton was running around saying, Assad must go and it's only a matter of time. At that time, I chose to use Assad as an example of the biblical meaning of the words pride and arrogance. So today, we will also be discussing the situation in Syria and the refugee crisis, as well as other atrocities in the Middle East, particularly the Saudi coalition invasion of Yemen and Bahrain. Our panel of commentators include our regular commentator, Professor Dave Westfall, Pastor Lane Beamer of First Christian Church in Whittier, a Disciples of Christ church, Randy Andoni Heinlam of the Middle East Ministry at All Saints Church in Pasadena, and my friend, Leah Stanley. My name is Rich Procida, and I write biblical commentary at modernlectionaries.blogspot.com. Let's begin. A reading from Sirach, chapter 10, verses 7 to 18. Arrogance is hateful to the Lord and to mortals, and justice is outrageous to both. Sovereignty passes from nation to nation on account of injustice and insolence and wealth. How can dust and ashes be proud? Even in life, the human body decays. A long illness baffles the physician. The king of today will die tomorrow. For when one is dead, he inherits maggots and vermin and worms. The beginning of human pride is to forsake the Lord. The heart has withdrawn from its maker. For the beginning of pride is sin, and the one who clings to it pours out abominations. Therefore, the Lord brings upon them unheard of calamities and destroys them completely. The Lord overthrows the thrones of rulers and enthrones the lowly in their place. The Lord plucks up the roots of the nations and plants the humble in their place. The Lord lays waste the lands of the nations and destroys them to the foundations of the earth. He removes some of them and destroys them and erases the memory of them from the earth. Pride was not created for human beings, or violent anger for those born of women. Think Impunity, Understanding Arrogance and Pride in the Bible, by Rich Procida. The Book of Sirach is part of the Apocrypha, Old Testament scripture not included in the Protestant canon. It is in Catholic and Eastern Orthodox Bibles, but not in most Protestant Bibles. Also known as Ecclesiasticus, it is a wisdom book popular with both Jews and early Christians. Many do not consider it divinely inspired, but I'm not so judgmental. It helps us to better understand the terms arrogance and pride as they are used in the Bible. The corruption of the arrogant and prideful is a common theme in the Bible. These words, as used in the Bible, are not about feeling good about yourself or your accomplishments. They're not even about being conceited or immodest. The book of Sirach describes arrogance as a form of hate, the devaluation of others in relation to oneself. Once devalued, evil is more easily done to others. Arrogance and pride are about the abuse of power. When you see these words in the Bible, think about corruption and institutional violence. Think impunity. Nothing could be more hateful than corruption, oppression, and violence. These lead to suffering, injustice, and death. This type of pride and arrogance is an affront to God and to all of humanity. The injustice they wreak is an outrage. Wars over territory and resources value material wealth over human life. Civilians suffer and die to enrich those in power. The insolence of wealth and power is a curse on us all. Consider the war in Syria. Assad may remain in power, but what type of nation will he rule? He has murdered his own citizens, destroyed his own country, and created a nation of enemies against him. Everyone dies. Life is in some ways a process of dying. In the end, we are fighting over dust. This is the atrocity. In the scheme of things, Assad is killing for nothing. His wealth and power are nothing in God's eyes. Spirit-filled people instead look to give their lives for something meaningful. It's easy to envision Assad's body full of maggots, vermin, and worms. He has forsaken God. The spirit has withdrawn from him, and his heart is cold, murderous, and dark. Oh, the abominations! Terrible calamities caused by arrogance are not limited to war. Global warming and environmental degradation, torture, crime, prejudice, poverty, and hunger are all the result of pride. Total destruction may yet be our end. The text implies that God brings destruction upon evildoers. The adage, "Live by the sword, die by the sword," contains truth. Yet we also know many evil people go unpunished in this life. Here, Sirach is more prescriptive than descriptive. God brings down the powerful by imbuing man with spirit. God works through people. We've witnessed people willing to risk their lives for justice, who stand in front of tanks and snipers for freedom and democracy. We've seen nations overthrown and dictators brought down by the power of people organized and taking to the streets. God inspires resistance. The roots of nations are the systemic and ingrained interest and institutions that serve to maintain the status quo. Patriarchy and imperialism are the roots of authoritarianism and corruption. God calls us to confront these false ideologies and to bring redemption to our lost institutions. We are called to bring good news to the poor, mass movements are composed of the most oppressed and marginalized people of a nation, those suffering under the current regime. These are the humble God raises up. Over time, right prevails. Those on the side of progress will not stop. The forces of regression cannot withstand the power of God. While some fear change and work to maintain their privilege, change will come. Those filled with the Spirit will not stop fighting for human and civil rights. This is one way God brings down the prideful and raises up the lowly. Consider the people of Syria. They will not tolerate dictatorship forever. Many have family and friends killed by Assad. In whatever form it takes, resistance will continue. Syrians will pursue democracy. It is their God-given right. Once they get it, they will hold it tight, remembering the cost and knowing what can happen without it. The lands of nations, what wars are often about, are nothing to God. The earth is the Lord's. No earthly ruler or nation owns it. What they have built are the systems of domination and oppression that maintain their own power and wealth. God would not only overthrow them, God would destroy them. Racism, authoritarianism, and unrestrained capitalism are hateful forms of arrogance that lead to injustice and death. These too will die and be remembered no more. Pride as a belief in one's superiority is unnatural. We are meant to love. Violence is not meant for those born of love and compassion. Rest assured that human beings are naturally peace-loving and humble. Pride and violence are abhorrent to our nature. They are a disease. God created human beings. We are God's children. Though many have been corrupted, we are not meant to be this way. As God's children, we naturally resist oppression and injustice. Love and compassion are our central features. Freedom and justice are basic demands. We will continually fight for these, and we will prevail because God is with us. Okay, so I'd like to begin the discussion by getting a little background on the situation in Syria and other parts of the Middle East. So, I did a little bit of research, but I'm going to turn it over to Randy. Or maybe I'll go ahead and read what I've done here. There are a number of groups fighting in Syria right now. Besides the Russians, there's the Syrian government. There's a number of rebel groups, such as the Syrian Democratic Forces, as well as ISIL and groups like al-Nusra, a group that's associated with al-Qaeda. And more recently, Turkey has intervened and has now begun fighting the Kurdish forces, which are part of the United States-backed Syrian Democratic Forces. So if we recall, the war began when Assad cracked down brutally on a pro-democracy protest in the Arab Spring of 2011. The Free Syrian Army formed soon after the crackdown, but that split into factions, with some pursuing Islamic extremist visions, such as al-Nusra and ISIL. The most recent estimates are either 400,000 or 470,000 people who have been killed in the Syrian war. The number includes 15,000 children and 10,000 women. Additionally, the United Nations has identified 13.5 million Syrians requiring humanitarian assistance, of which 6.6 million are internally displaced within Syria, and another 4.8 million are refugees outside of Syria. So this war has taken a massive toll on the people of and children of Syria. So it's killed upwards of 11.5% of the Syrian population, and there have been 1.9 million wounded. So it's been a terrible event, Randy. You can give us some insight into what's going on here?
Sure. Well, I can try, Rich. First of all, thanks for inviting us to be a part of the podcast here. Just as a little bit of background and a disclaimer, neither Doni, my wife, nor I are experts on the Middle East, except in the fact that we have been working together with the Middle East Ministry at All Saints. The Middle East Ministry is an educational and advocacy ministry that has been around for more than a dozen years now, and was first started out of a response to what was going on in Israel and Palestine, and has since expanded our vision to try to educate our own community and the wider Pasadena area about the issues that are going on in the Middle East. You and the writer of Sirach have given us a lot to digest here today. And when we start talking about pride and arrogance, we can go back a long way in the political history of the Middle East. Probably a place I would have us jump in, because it has to do with the Western powers too, is to take us back to the formation of the state of Syria sometime back in the period after the First World War. With the fall of the Ottoman Empire, the Western powers, primarily Britain and France, decided to carve up the Middle East and install leaders that were favorable to trade, especially oil, for the West. And so they artificially drew a lot of lines on a map, and so that's why you have in Syria you have a number of different groups, from Sunnis and Shias together. You have in the Muslim community you have Druze, you have Christians, you have all these groups all in one, under one state, with one leader in the form of currently Bashar al-Assad, and his father Hafez al-Assad before him, pretty much installed by the West to do what they had hoped and have the kind of relationships that they'd have. So once again, you've got that issue of arrogance and pride, and are sort of deciding we're going to control the lives of millions of people in the Middle East by the way we draw maps. But you're right. I mean, our current situation is in Syria is a terrible mess, and it's hard to see any kind of way out of it that's going to be able to be accomplished in the near future. You do have various competing groups. Assad is in power and will probably, at least in the short term, remain in power, if not for other reasons, because he has the backing of the Soviet, or for the former Soviet Union, Russia, and they have their own economic and military interests in the area. They have a large naval base at the seaport of Tartur that they want to hold on to. They have gas and oil contracts with the Syrians that they would like to see fulfilled, and in Assad they have someone who has been willing to work with them. On the other side, you have the United States wanting to see that a different type of government comes into play, preferably one that would be more amenable to our interests, or our national interests, shall we say, in the Middle East. So add to that the fact that you have a bit of a proxy battle going on, probably a lot of a proxy battle going on between the Shia in Iran, who have good relationships with Assad, who is part of an Alawite Shia sect, and then you have a majority Sunni population in Syria that probably has closer ties to the Saudis, and there's been a lot of Saudi money as well as Iranian money that have been pumped into this battle, not to mention what's going on with the United States and Russia. So we've got pretty much of a mess.
And how is what I'm reading now is that Turkey is in, there's this battle between the Kurds, who are American forces, and Kurdish people.
Yeah, Turkey adds a whole new dimension to this. Obviously, having a large border with northern Syria, they are very much impacted and have been the first place for a lot of refugees. Of course, a lot have also gone to places like Lebanon and to Jordan as well. But certainly millions of people have either passed through already or have are now stuck perhaps in Turkey because they can't go on to Europe, with the Europeans closing their doors tighter and tighter against refugees and not having a place to go to at home any longer. Many of them are stuck there, and that brings on a whole new dimension. One of the smaller groups in Syria, as well as in Iraq, has been the Kurdish minority, which sees themselves as separate from the Arabs, who make up the majority of Syria. And the Kurds have long wanted to have a state of their own and have independence, or at least autonomy, within the states that are existing there. And the Turks are not particularly wanting to give the Kurds in their own country that type of autonomy. And many of the Kurds in Turkey want to have joined together with their brothers and sisters across the border in Syria and Iraq and form a state. So you have this internal politics that's going on, and even though the United States has generally been supportive of Kurdish claims, especially because they were supportive of U.S. efforts in Iraq, at the same time, we have many treaties and arrangements with the Turks as well. Yeah. And so we find ourselves in a situation where we are backing the Kurds, who are not friends of the Turks, and yet we're trying to support the Turks' effort and encourage the Turks to fight ISIL, or Daesh, as they sometimes referred to in Arabic, keep radical extremism from taking over in Syria.
And you mentioned the refugees. Do you have any information on what's going on in that situation?
Well, refugees, there's more than a million refugees who are probably in Lebanon alone. And considering that the population of Lebanon is, about 10 million or so, 12 million, if you had the same number of people coming into the United States, proportionally, you would probably be having somewhere around 23 million refugees suddenly flooding into or 35 million refugees flooding into the United States. So you can imagine the demographic problem that it presents for the Lebanese, and of course for the aid agencies that try to provide support to them. The internally displaced refugees often have it the hardest, because they are still subject to not only the deprivations of not being in their home, but also the problems of having ongoing war going on around them. We've all been moved, I think, by the pictures of the young boy who was pulled from the rubble recently and was deposited in the back of an ambulance and sat there covered in dust and mud and blood and sort of wiping his face, not even realizing the extent of his own circumstances, his injuries, and his circumstances of having lost many of his families to a barrel bomb that was dropped by the authorities, Syrian government authorities that were bombing a rebel-held area where he, as a three-year-old, happened to be residing, totally innocent of anything in terms of, except being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
And there's supposed to be a new push for this Russian peace agreement, sort of ceasefire in Syria, and the U.S. is trying to brokering a ceasefire with Russia.
And yet we don't seem to be able to get even a 48-hour ceasefire to allow for humanitarian aid at this point.
Yeah. Well.
So I'm afraid that the situation for the internally displaced people is not a good one in the short term. Our own church has sponsored a Syrian family, to come to the United States, and it's a small effort. It's one family out of literally millions of people who are coming. But I think all of us, people of faith, need to look into our hearts and say, what can we do to change the situation? Because I don't think the answer is going to come in the short term from governments. I think the possibility of seeing any kind of lasting peace agreement coming out of negotiations is probably a long-term effort rather than a short-term effort.
Interesting. So, Pastor Beamer, what do you think about all of this?
One, I want to appreciate the going back to, you know, we could go back further, but particularly going back to, you know, say after World War I, and then again certainly after World War II, where the powers that be or the powers that were came in and I would think to local residents arbitrarily drew lines that split up families and, you know, greatly affected lives. I always bring it back as a local pastor, you know, I bring it back to a congregational level. I bring it back and I see within our own families sometimes how the inability to tell the truth about something keeps us caught in cycles. And so the notion of let's make sure we're telling our whole story, we're told the truth will set us free, and we too often don't know the story. I don't know the story. I have to be reminded because it seems like this, and it is this convoluted. Now wait a minute. I thought they were the bad guys. Well, we were told they were the bad guys, but in fact, we were behind, you know, that right. that coup or that movement or the weapons that were turned against our soldiers were in fact our weapons that were there from a previous regime, and so I think. Truth-telling, owning our part and our greed, our arrogance, our not only once upon a time but ongoing, because it's too easy to say, well, they, mm-hmm. well, why don't they and why can't they? And until we do something like that, we can't reclaim any sort of moral high ground. So we end up just continuing to be the bully and wonder why they hate us, and you know, I can't imagine the political cost. But for someone to actually stand up in this country and speak the whole truth from a place of power, you know, we have voices that lift it up on the fringes. But to say one, I want to own this, and to whatever degree possible, I want to. Apologize for it, to admit that it is has spun out of control, rightfully anything we try to do at this point is viewed skeptically across the board. We don't in our own country now. When you say our interests, we don't agree on what those are. Largely because we don't have a shared understanding of what we've done in the world, but we don't trust our politicians and our diplomats when they tell us well the truth about what's going on over there, because we've seen it in hindsight. We see we've been fed partial truths or untruths in the past. Anyway, I yearn for. Sort of some sort of solid ground where I can say, well, I know where we stand in this mess, and then from there to try to figure out, okay, so now what's our part in moving forward? Because I don't even trust my own sense of justice in some cases, because I don't know enough. You know, I don't know enough.
So sometimes, often our scripture is like reduced to simple matters of etiquette or good manners. As a teenager, I remember hearing sermons about being prideful and being humble. And sometimes it made me wonder, should I even feel good about myself? You know, every time I felt good about myself or felt pride in myself, it was like that word got mixed up with that. But when we read the Bible, there are examples of pride and arrogance, say in the Magnificat, and how does this meaning change our theology or how we should look at this problem, Pastor Beamer?
Well, you know, the idea, I don't know how many folks know Garrison Keillor, an NPR comedian, I guess, mm-hmm. but he, although he didn't actually grow up Lutheran, he often talks about growing up Lutheran, and, you know, the humility is the best virtue, and you have to be careful of pride. I grew up Lutheran, and had much that same sense. You know, be careful, careful, that's pride, that's pride. But tempering and, I guess, being, again, honest about what you're proud in, the idea that none of us are self-made, we have been given gifts, and, you know, whether that's by God or our families or our culture, and acknowledging that without those gifts, we could not be what we are. I think the idea, I think, I'm so not a chapter and verse guy, but Paul would tell us, be proud of what God does in you and through you, you know, so that you're not standing on some sort of self-made pedestal, being proud in that, but to not be proud of what God can do in you and through you and has blessed you with is to not be grateful for those things, I guess, you know. Too often we, you know, church folk in particular can put people down by saying, oh, careful, that's, you're being proud, when the, you know, perhaps the right thing to remind is you've been given great gifts, and you should be really grateful and proud of what you can do in the world because of the gifts you've been given. And I think that's, again, that's certainly something for us in the United States. We have this notion that we're exceptional. Well, we're only exceptional because we came on the scene late and we had all these great resources and we wiped out indigenous peoples. And so false pride, you know, we have done great good in the world. People lift up World War II, you know, as an example of that. But we were only able to do that because of our unique place and time and history, and not because of some innate goodness within us. And that, when you go there, then it's false pride, and that then becomes the basis for continuing arrogant behavior out in the world. Well, I deserve to do this because look how good I am and how good I've been in the past. I'm the one who should step in here and settle this, if you will, or, you know, we're the great liberators in some way, forgetting, well, we've messed up more times than we've been right, you know.
Other times that we get lessons that seem impossible. Just last month, we discussed the Good Samaritan. David was here for that, and we can't possibly do what the Good Samaritan did for every poor and homeless person we see. We learned that when we reduce Scripture to lessons on personal morality, God's demands sometimes appear impossible. But when, on the other hand, we consider the full meaning of the words, we see that it's not impossible from a collective or social justice perspective. Governments can address our nation's social problems, whereas we as individuals can do very little. So collectively, we can do much more. And we can actually maybe do some of these things that the Good Samaritan or did. Or so I'm wondering, what's your opinion on this, Dave, Professor Westfall? Is Christianity about personal piety or social justice or both? And which one's more important to you?
I think you got an interesting idea here, the idea that we can't do it all. You look at all these problems in the world, and it looks just impossible, okay? But the fact of the matter is we can only do what we can do. But each one of us can do something somewhere, someplace, okay? And I think, you know, pray about these things, and if there's something that you or I can do in particular situations we're all involved with, you know, one person means nothing. Actually, in an election, one vote means nothing. But it, when you put it all together, it adds up to somebody, something, some winner, and so forth. So, you know, and I think there are a lot of things that, you know, organized Christianity can do and has done, okay? The rescue mission movement started out in Glasgow, Scotland, in around 1820, 1830, somewhere around there, And it's come out and worked its way out to the United States. And honestly, we had rescue missions here that were concerned about the homeless for 100 years before anybody started thinking about, well, gee, the homeless is a big issue. Okay, and these people are out there doing things. They're getting a lot of volunteer labor. They're getting donations and so forth to help out. And they've worked out some ways of doing things, that has been effective for a lot of people. I mean, I know a guy who wasn't exactly a rescue mission, but he was a drug addict, okay? And he went through the Teen Challenge program, and he got off drugs, and he was able to stay off drugs, And so, there's lots of different things people can do in a lot of different places, okay? And sometimes government programs can help, and sometimes government programs get to be kind of self-perpetuating, and you start seeing scandals. You see things like the foster care system, and there have been, there's some lot of things out there through that public system that haven't worked out real well, okay? Another thing I think is kind of important is the whole concept of whistleblowers, okay? Like I say, if you see something, say something, okay? And a lot of times it's very hard for somebody to blow the whistle on something that's going wrong because they might lose their own job because of it or something. So anyway, I think, if everybody, I can't do it all, but I can do something. I see some trash on the street. I can pick it up and throw it in the trash can. Okay, and we can pray. And,
if we speak out, we could be exiled to Russia or thrown in the brig. So, how does this reading give us hope, Leah? Is because evil sometimes prevails in this world, and the. And I think the first century people could be excused for not seeing any way to overthrow their oppressors without God's supernatural intervention. But today we can support and participate in movements for social justice. Are we in a hopeless situation destined for Armageddon and the end of the world?
Well, I hear that a lot. I think as Christians, sometimes we forget that it begins within ourselves, that it begins with one person. And, it does seem overwhelming. The issues are, I hear a lot. This is, we don't have time to, we have homeless here to take care of. We can't take care of the refugees in Syria. But it goes back to who's our neighbor, the last podcast that I listened to. And, we have to look inward and outward, and everybody has a little piece that they need to put in. And I think that a lot of times it becomes overwhelming. I know for myself, I think I'm not, what am I going to be able to do? What is just little old me going to be able to do? And I think it takes a lot of courage sometimes for people to even step out and help. A lot of people, they get discouraged because of the there's so many issues that have to be taken care of. But I think that it's just it's something that we all need to come back to within the churches and within ourselves.
I wanted to get back to the Middle East because the Arab Spring, we think, it's not really over because Yemen had a massive protest against the U.S.-backed Syrian, but apparently there's a coalition of many Middle Eastern nations that are backing the Syrian incursion or invasion of Yemen after the Saudi had to leave after the protest. There was a major protest not too long ago. Can you tell us what's going on in Yemen?
First, I'd like to say, regarding the comments about prayer, the thing that came to mind when you were speaking was, let's not have our prayer divorced from action, mm-hmm. or our actions divorced from prayer. Mm-hmm. It's not one or the other. It's both together. Regarding poor Yemen, Yemen was hit by more drone strikes from the United States than any other countries combined. So they were already in a rather devastated condition. And then the Saudis began bombing. And it made no sense to me why the Saudis had chosen Yemen until a friend, Will Picard, who is an expert on Yemen, said, well, you know, Saudi is not really bombing Yemen because they have a hatred for Yemenis. Saudi is showing Iran, we could do this to you. And it made suddenly so much sense to me that it was major players looking at a much larger sphere than little Yemen.
And many of these countries, Saudi Arabia included, have groups within them that are somewhat restive. And so this sends an internal message as well as an external message. Don't mess around or you might be the next recipient of the battles. Yemen, of course, like many of the Arab states in the post-Arab Spring period, has had they've had a long-standing civil war going on with the Houthis in the north, finally forcing out the government a couple of years ago that was replaced by another government that has had to move a couple of different places just to continue to have some sort of semblance of authority and power. But you really have a situation where there is no central government of Yemen anymore. And so the Saudis look to try to fill that void and do whatever, inflict whatever damage they can on people who they think might oppose them. And as Donnie mentioned, this is a bit of a proxy war once again between the Sunni-led government of Saudi Arabia and the Shia-led government of Iran, with many Shia in portions of Yemen. This is a way of striking out at Iran and making it clear that Iran should not get too bold in its designs to run Middle East politics.
And I was, Donnie, thank you for your comments. I was wondering, that I sort of see it as an anti-democratic type of position that, no, we're not going to have this democracy next door. We're not a democracy, Saudi Arabia, and we don't believe in democracy. We believe in rule by us, basically. And so we're going to support this authoritarianism and make sure to overthrow these democratic movements, which they see as a threat to them.
Yes, I'd agree with that. Saudi Arabia, as we know, is a monarchy and has tended to very much keep things within the family. And I'm sure the movement toward democracy around them is not appreciated. That's certainly not acceptable within the country or in nearby neighbors. So it's not surprising. Yeah.
I would be careful, though, Rich, about overestimating the move towards democracy. I think what people are often looking for is they're looking for economic gains, and not necessarily in a bad way. I mean, they're looking for a life that they see other people in the world having. So, you know, if you go back to the beginning of the Arab Spring, the first nation to experience this type of thing was Tunisia. And the Tunisian spark was lit when, and I don't mean that as a pun now that I think about what happened, but that was one man who was unable, because of the bureaucracy of the situation, to get a permit to have a street vendor stand. And with that, his hopes and dreams for an apartment of his own, being able to marry in the future, all these things were suddenly at risk because he couldn't make a living. And so he decided, as a way of protesting his inability to get a permit to have a street vendor's cart, he set himself on a light and immolated himself. And it was that event that galvanized the Tunisian people to rise up against a corrupt and ineffective government within there. From there, you had situations erupt throughout North Africa, and to a lesser degree in the rest of the Middle East, that we're still having reverberations from. Of course, in Egypt, you had a situation where we all watched with amazement as millions of people filled Tahrir Square and were able to successfully overthrow the government that they saw as oppressing them. And yet, in the years to follow, we've seen a counter-revolution and a coup that overthrew the Islamic government that was formed in its wake. And you have Christians, 10% of the population of Egypt are Coptic Christian, and their particular situation has not been addressed by either group. And so you have a very restive group of Copts within Egypt who don't appreciate either the government that replaced the one that fell or the government that has come since that time. So, you know, a lot of times it may not even be about democracy. It may just be about finding a way to live. In Syria, you know, people don't realize the effect to which other things that affect us as well affect them. So when we talk about global warming and climate change, Syria has been going through a drought for a number of years, and many of the farmers who were in the south of the country were no longer able to irrigate their fields, and so they were leaving their farms and moving to the city and not finding there the types of work or the types of benefits that would allow them to feed their families. And so they came out in protest in the streets. And that was the start of the Syrian conflict. It wasn't so much a search for democracy, though democracy has certainly been a part of that, and the ability to express themselves freely is certainly a part of all of this. But it often is even a much more basic level of just being able to live and have the types of hopes and dreams that we take for granted in this country.
What do you think is the U.S. role in the coup in Egypt?
Oh, well, the U.S. hates a vacuum as much as anybody else does, I suppose, and we would like to fill it with people who are supportive of our interests. And so maintaining, you know, in Egypt, maintaining a good relationship with continuing of the peace accords between Egypt and Israel is certainly an important factor for the Americans to consider. Maintaining the openness of the Suez Canal with the effects on trade of moving oil and other goods through the Suez Canal on its way from or to the Middle East and farther east is certainly an important factor in all of this. So the United States wants to have stability, and it wants to have friends. And so if it can manipulate the situation to find a friendly and stable government, however repressive it might be, that's in their interests.
Now, in Yemen, there's supposed to be a new peace accord being ironed out. I'm not sure if you were, I looked that up with the Houthis giving up their heavy artillery, pulling out of, is it Sana'a? Is that the capital?
Sana'a,
the capital. Mm-hmm. And in exchange, there will be a swiftly created unity government in which the Houthis will be allowed to participate. What do you think about the prospects on that?
It's really hard to say at this point. I think that people there are certainly tired of war, but I think that there are larger interests at stake, that whether we're talking about Yemen or whether we're talking about Syria, that perpetuate this type of war far beyond when normally you would see a conflict stop because people are just tired of it. I wish them peace. And I hope that some sort of a situation, some sort of circumstances can be worked out that would allow people to carry on with their lives. But I'm not particularly hopeful.
Well, Syrian is in a transition, not Syria, but Libya is in a transition right now as well. And there seems to be some hope for some type of government in Libya.
Yeah, we really have nothing there. And so you have in the eastern sections of Libya, where the pipelines are, you have one group that's in control there. And then in the western portions, in the capital and other places, you've not had a lot in terms of stable government. So any effort to stabilize the situation, I think, will bring calm. But you know, at what price? What are the devil's in the details, as they say? And I don't know the details of that kind of an agreement.
Okay, Pastor Beamer, let's see here. So how does God work in these situations? You know, throughout Scripture, just my little take from Abraham to Noah and to Moses and King David, all the way to Jesus and the saints, God has always used people to further His plans. How can God use us to bring about peace and justice?
It's my Claremont School of Theology would have me say, well, the way we tell the story, that's how God works. So, you know, but yeah, we recognize in our story that God does call people to step forward in certain ways, and we in some cases do so successfully. We often ignore the call or get it twisted. We overstep the call. We go beyond what we were asked to do. We misheard. In some cases, when we look back on history, we will say, well, surely that's not the right message that God wanted to convey at the time. You know, we now look back and say, could God really have said, you know, kill the unborn baby in the womb, you know, make sure that even the, you know, the animals are dead when you leave? We like to look back on that and go, I think you misheard the message at the time. But you said something about, you know, we just headed toward an apocalypse, and we may be, I think the great promise is that God will endure. So if I am influenced greatly by process theology, and certainly there's a place in that for individual agency and for actually a real ownership of, you know, what I do really does make a difference, that God is dependent on creation, not just man, but on creation to respond to, you know, God's call. And when we get it wrong, it often has devastating results. But the promise, even in process theology, is that God is going to outlast the rest of us, if you will. God has always outlasted every regime, every dynasty, and continues to call then forward or transform good out of the bad in the face of ongoing bad, to keep sending good and love and the call for peace forward. So that if only we get it completely wrong and we humans pass from the earth because we just don't get it right in time, God will endure and peace will reign on earth. At least the lack of human violence will reign on earth, you know. I think something else for us to think about is the idea that when God makes promises, especially in the Old Testament, you know, He's making promises to people over a long period of time, not that any one of us may in our lifetime experience peace or in prosperity, but that your people will at some point. And we see where that's come to pass, and then it slipped away again. But we see that God keeps trying through us and through other, you know, powers of be to bring about peace and justice, and you know, that's what we're called to act toward.
Rich, if you don't mind, I'd just like to take something back to what Rachel was saying earlier too, and that's that we all need to find a place where we can become active. obviously, our interest has been for many years in the Middle East, and so we've tried to educate ourselves. We've tried to continue to pray. We've tried to find out what we can and to act where we can. The Middle East may not be everyone's issue who's listening to this podcast, but the point is to find the issue that is, whether it be issues of racial justice, education, whatever it might be. There are so many areas where someone can put a finger in the dike and make a difference. Mm-hmm. And so the point is to find that place that ignites your heart and to say, I'm going to educate myself about this. I'm going to learn what I can, and then I'm going to act based on the knowledge that I have. And I'm going to find ways to reach out. With us, it might be sponsoring a Syrian family, or it might be providing education about what's going on in Yemen so that the average person who reads the LA Times and sees a story maybe once every 6 months is a little better educated as to what's going on. But for your listeners and for all of us around the table here today, what is it that lights our hearts? Mm-hmm. And follow that and do something about it.
And it may also be linking issues that we see. Though we're very involved in the Middle East, we can't only be involved in the Middle East and be thousands of miles away. We have to be concerned about the homeless that are around us. We have to be concerned about economic justice and racial justice, and to see those links between our friends in the Middle East and the people that are here as well. So it's not just looking off to some distant mm-hmm. goal. It's working and being active with people that are our neighbors, near and far, as you mentioned before, Leah.
We see and hear calls for building a wall between the United States and Mexico, and we make parallels between the wall that goes up in Israel and Palestine. And you separate people, you keep them from having any interaction, and they see each other as enemies. You break down those walls, as I've heard it said many times before, bridges are much better than walls.
This has been Bible Study for Progressives. You can find us on Stitcher, Podbean, Facebook, and Meetup. I'd like to thank Dodie and Randy for coming, Pastor Beamer, Professor Westfall, and my friend Leah. So you can also find our blog, my blog on modernlectionaries.blogspot.com. Until next time, this is Rich Procida. Thank you for listening.